The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
There's a verse in the Bible, and I don't have this one memorized, but it's in 1 Chronicles 12:32, and it says, "And if the children of Issachar, which were men also who had understanding of the times, to know what Israel ought to do." And I'm using that verse because it makes me think of our speaker here this afternoon. And we are all very pleased and thankful to be able to present our guest plenary speaker. And this gentleman is the great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, who is the Dublin Brewer. Is there an amen? Okay. He was born in China, not his great-great-grandfather, but our speaker. And he was born in China during World War II, and then 1941. And his two parents were medical missionaries, he was a witness to the climax of the Chinese Revolution in 1949. He was expelled with many other foreigners in 1951 and returned to Europe, where he was educated in England. He completed his undergraduate degree at the University of London and his doctorate of philosophy in the social sciences from Oriel College, Oxford. He's a well-known speaker, social critic, and author. He's written and edited over 25 books, including Fit Bodies, Fat Minds, Why Evangelicals Don't Think, and What to Do About It, The American Hour, Time for Truth, The Call, Imitation of the Classics, Long Journey Home, Unspeakable, Facing Up to the Challenge of Evil, and then his most recent, I think it is, it might be something more recent than this, but it's the most recent I could find, it's The Last Christian on Earth, Uncovered the Enemy's Plot to Determine, or to Undermine the Church, published in February of this year. Anything more recent than that? Okay. Since coming to the United States in 1984, he's been a guest scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies, and a guest scholar and visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. From 1986 to 1989, he served as executive director of the Williamsburg Charter Foundation, a bicentennial celebration of the First Amendment. He is currently a senior fellow of the East-West Institute in New York and is a co-founder of the Trinity Forum, having served as senior fellow from 1991 until 2004. And as a European visitor to the United States and a great admirer, a detached observer of American culture today, he stands in the long tradition of outside voices who have contributed so much to America's ongoing discussion about the State of the Union. So would you all please join with me in extending a warm welcome to our guest, Dr. Oz Guinness.
Thank you, Patch. Thank you all. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here. I myself went to a school which was rich in the classics in England, and I had absolutely no idea how rare that was. I can well remember my headmaster, who taught us Latin and Greek, twirling his academic gown and talking about Pericles as if he was knew him as well as he knew Winston Churchill, whom he did actually know. But he made the classics come alive in the most extraordinary way. So it's a real privilege for me, because I admire and esteem what you've done enormously. In the late 60s, I was part of the Brie community with Francis Schaeffer. And it's extraordinary that remote little village had extraordinary ripples that went around the Christian world. And to see today what's come out of Moscow and the way you are shaping so much of the Christian culture is truly remarkable, and I thank the Lord for it, and it's a genuine privilege to be here. I very rarely speak on any book I've written on, with the one exception when I'm urged to on the call. And you ask me, so I will. But let me start at a very different place than I did in the book. because calling is something that has either personal ways into it or very public ways into it. Let me take the second and start with it. A number of years ago, I was in Shanghai at the business school, and I was asked to speak to China's CEO Forum. Fascinating day's discussion. And at the end of it, I walked back from the final banquet to the lecture hall with the dean of the business school, and he said, "Let me ask you a question I wouldn't raise in public." He said, "What am I missing? We in China are fascinated with the Christian roots of the Western past for the sake of China's future. But you in the West are cutting off your roots. What am I missing?" Sadly, he was dead right. We've been discussing things that day like the influence of the Christian faith on the rise of philanthropy, on modern science, or democracy, or capitalism, or human rights, and all sorts of things like this. But obviously the question behind that is, what was it that gave rise out of the Christian faith to many of these things? And if you ask that deeper question, clearly you come down to a handful of Christian truths which have shaped history and culture profoundly. And at the very top circle, you have to put the notion of calling. This notion that has changed history and shaped culture. And yet today, is often recognized by its absence. I don't know if you know the name Said Qutb, one of Osama bin Laden's favorite writers, a radical from the Muslim Brotherhood who was hanged by Nasser many years ago, but gives a definitive critique of Western decadence. But Said Qutb tells how he discovered his Islamic faith, rediscovered it, in America. How? In contrast to what he saw of the Christian churches. And this in the 1940s, before the counterculture, drugs, sex, rock and roll, the Berkeley free speech movement, and so on, before all that, when white picket fence America was still intact. But his comment on the churches he saw in the 40s, they were suffering from grotesque, as he called it elsewhere, a hideous schizophrenia. As the later critic of the Californian churches put it, the churches have become privately engaging, publicly irrelevant. Now you could say that in much fancier ways, but that's surely the central reason why we today can be the huge majority in the United States, and yet have much less cultural influence than tiny minorities, like say the gays and the lesbians. And obviously behind that problem, privately engaging, public development, grotesquely schizophrenic, is a lack of calling which once made the greatness to this country. In other words, the Lordship of Christ everywhere. And there's no question today that the main problem of Christians in America is not that we aren't where we should be. There are places where we'd like to see a lot more believers. The main problem is that we're not what we should be wherever we are. And that, of course, goes to the heart of the absence of a biblical and a Reformation view of calling. If we were following the Lordship of Christ as a response to calling, this country would not be in the problem it is. But look at it in a more personal way for the charge. I begin my book with the story of a Trinity Forum, the first one, in fact, in Europe. And at the end of the forum, they were all sharing with each other various things, and one of the mega-millionaires said, "As you know, I've made a lot of money in my life." You could almost see people winking because they knew he had. He said, "To be really honest, one of my driving motives to make the money is to be able to hire people to do what I don't like doing." And everyone was thought he was working out to some quip, but he almost choked, and the tear, a single tear, rolled down his very well-tanned cheek, and he said, "The only trouble with that is I've never been able to hire anyone to discover my sense of purpose and fulfillment in life. If you follow the responses to, say, Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life, the remarkable thing behind its huge success in sales is not just that it appeals, say, to young people, looking for the meaning of life as they set out in life, but that many of the titans of our world, the Bill Gateses, the Jack Welches, and so on, have found Rick to say they touch chords in them as they were looking for deep answers to the meaning of life. Now, clearly, America today is kind of like a cut flower civilization. This is the most purposeful, dynamic country probably in history. And yet it's cut the roots from where that dynamism and purpose came from. But if you compare the other worldviews and faiths on offer, clearly none of them could give a sense of purpose which comes from the gospel and from a sense of calling. Take the Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, the New Age, and so on. Everything is seen in terms of a cycle, a circle. Reincarnation, for instance, is not, unlike the 60s Californians, groovy man groovy, but a matter of weary fatalistic resignation. As the Hindus say, you go around maybe 35,000 times. And the problem is not that you die, but that you're reborn and go around again, and the whole goal is to escape the wheel. There's no driving dynamism that you can see in the Hindu or Buddhist cultures. Or you take the secularist worldview, which has taken over the educated classes of much of the world today. I knew as a student Bertrand Russell. When I was at Oxford, I knew H.A. Eyre, the great logical positivist. If you read the works of the great atheist, everything, as Russell says, comes from chance and moves towards ultimate extinction. So there's no meaning in the universe. If we want meaning, it's a do-it-yourself meaning. We create it ourselves. We don't discover it. As Nietzsche says, you so live to be able to say, thus I will. All up to us. Fine. For the young, the strong, the wealthy, with cultural opportunities and so on. But for most people in life, an absurd way of finding meaning and purpose. And not surprisingly, Western dynamism and Western purposes is rooted above all in calling. Because if you think about it, calling for us as individuals is almost a parallel for the way that purpose and design comes into the very cosmos itself. And the word said, let there be. And this extraordinary cosmos comes into being with all its complexity and design. But as we follow Jesus and his words, follow me, we enter into God's vision for purpose for our individual lives. And we rise higher, we go further, and we're in touch with parts of ourselves. Even we don't know about ourselves, let alone those who love us. But our great Creator knows and has in mind for us all along. So you can think of this topic calling either in terms of its grand public significance or in terms of its very private and personal significance. But it truly is an extraordinary topic. Let me stop and define it, because there's a lot of confusion today as to what it means. Then add some reminders, particularly out of the Reformed discussion of it, and then, most importantly of all, raise some of the great master themes that calling is introduced into the world. And you ask yourself if these things characterize your life and your work. What do I mean, though, by calling? Calling means that when we respond to those words, follow me, everything we are, everything we have, and everything we do is given a direction and a dynamic because it's now done as unto him, as part of our calling. Let me quickly add some Reformation distinctions to clear up a lot of the confusion. The first is the Reformers' distinction between our primary call and our secondary call. The primary call, as it were, is by the Lord, to the Lord, for the Lord. We're not primarily called to anything or to anywhere. We're called to someone, not something or somewhere. We're called to Him. We're called by Him. And we're called for Him. Our secondary calling, as the Reformers put it, is everything we do in response to His call. And you can immediately see that that word secondary calling is a misnomer. It's not a calling at all, it's actually a responding. But that response to His calling, everyone in every part of their life, is what they call secondary calling. Lawyers in law, homemakers in their home, and so on and so on and so on. Now the key thing in making that distinction is that they must be held together. The first is always first, for the second is always second and must be closely linked. A second distinction, very important in the modern world and especially in America. The Reformers distinction between an individual, or what they call a particular calling, and a corporate, collective calling. This is important because we're in a highly, atomistically individualistic society. So we only think of ourselves as individuals, rather than the body of Christ. Now, for the Reformers, and for the New Testament, of course, we all have a corporate calling. If we're followers of Jesus, we're called to follow His way, which is to come to know Him, to live out what He calls us to live out, and to make disciples of others as we're disciples too. We're called to many things collectively. We're all called to be holy. We're all called to be peacemakers, etc., etc., etc. So just by virtue of our being Christians, we're followers of Jesus who enter and hold an allegiance to a common calling. And that we must never forget. Now, at the same time, we're individuals. Made in the image of God, each one of us is unique, each one of us is distinctive. So we have a common calling together, but we also have, with our own individual gifts and so on, our own particular calling. Now, the danger in an individualistic society is to stress the second only at the expense of the first. And if ever we're doing things and saying this is the Lord's calling and using God's canvas signature to give us permission to do what we like, that's dangerous. Everything we do in our individual calling should serve and reflect all that we do together in our common calling as Christians. And clearly, in America in the last 30 years, you take the extremes of the religious right. Much of what people have done has brought dishonor to the name of Christ. Instead of, say, loving their enemies, speaking the truth with love, they've demonized and stereotyped their enemies. And you can see the name of Christ itself has been dishonored, and all of us have been tarnished with their brush. The third little distinction is one that's been made more recently, but very, very important in the light of the present confusion. The distinction between an ordinary calling and a special calling. What do I mean? There is no Christian without a call. That's what I said. We're called to follow the way of Jesus. We have our calling. A full-time, challenging, demanding calling. There's no Christian without a call. So Christians who sit around waiting for God's call, they miss the point. We are followers of Jesus. That is our ordinary calling. But you can see in the scriptures and down through history, some people have a special calling because God speaks to them specially, directly, supernaturally, telling them to do what they're to do, maybe against the run of their normal expectations or background. Take, say, a prophet like Amos. When Amos is challenged, he says, I'm neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet. And as you know, Amos was a farmer. But clearly, in Amos' time, in Israel and the northern kingdom, the prophets who were supposed to be carrying the word of God to the people of God were so corrupt that God bypassed them completely, and he called, especially, prophet to carry the word than the more formal prophets had failed. And you see many times, and for other reasons too, many people were called supernaturally by the Lord to do things out of the ordinary, out of what they expect. Now here's the problem. Usually those stories of the special calls are so dramatic that they make magnificent stories. And then preachers on Sunday morning tell those stories. Here is this eminent surgeon in Manhattan, and out of the blue, God talks to him directly, tells him to go to Zambia and give up everything he's doing, and so on and so on. They make dramatic stories, and preachers make the most of the dramatic stories. And then the congregations listen, and what happens is that the experience of the minority becomes the expectation of the majority. And everyone listens and says, well, that's incredible. I haven't heard that. Maybe I haven't been called. So the effect is millions of Christians sitting around waiting for it. For a vision of a man from Macedonia or a voice telling us exactly what to do. But the Lord does not speak to everyone in terms of their calling directly and supernaturally. We're all called to follow Jesus and to live his way. We have our call. If the Lord wants to directly step in and calls us to something very, very specific, that's up to the Lord. But that's usually, both in Scripture and in history, that is the privilege of the minority and not the majority. So people will sit around waiting for it. Is one of the reasons the effect is many people, in effect, have put their calling in a napkin on the ground and then waiting until the Lord's come because they've never heard what it is. But we have our call. So be very aware that you're not waiting for something special and forgetting what it is to follow him day to day as he's called us to. Having defined it that way, made those three distinctions, let me go on to raise some of the great master themes that I have seen in my own life, and I've seen in the lives of great saints in history or today, that make a great difference if you wrestle with this until calling becomes the great motivating factor in your life. Firstly, this calling means do what you are. Do what you are. I tell the story in the book of Yehudi Menuhin. Grew up in a Jewish family, a relatively poor Jewish family in San Francisco, but a very musical family that took him from the age of three to the symphony. And for the very first time, he was fascinated with the lead violins. Not the conductor, not the trumpeter blaring away, but the violins. And when he was nearly four, he asked his dad if he could have a violin for his birthday, having no idea what it cost. Later, when he was a great maestro, he had two Stradivariuses. But at that age, his family were very poor. But his father, to humor him, told a friend of theirs, little Yehudi wanted this, and the friend gave him on his fourth birthday a toy violin, made of metal with metal strings. And when Menuhin was 80, he described how he took this toy violin and smashed it on the floor in front of his father and his father's friends, not realizing the social gaucheness. But he said, I knew that to me, to play was to be. Even at the age of four, to play was to be. And this thing was all wrong. Now, with geniuses and virtuosi, you often see that huge gift, say Mozart style, breaking through early. Most of us are not geniuses or virtuosi. We have a greater range of giftedness, and it probably bubbles through later. But you can see that calling at its heart is the employment of the giftedness God has given us. The giftedness are natural resources given back to him as a response to his call. Gerard Manny Hopkins says, what I do is me, for that I came. And you can see today that that's the reverse of our modern times. We are what we do in the modern world. And if you remember the old film, The Graduate, as Ben graduates, his father's friend's advice in one word, Ben, plastics. In the corporate world, have this great promise, you are what you do. And you can say what you do. It's just that the other Washington. You know, in about 30 seconds of any reception, they'll be like, what do you do? And you define yourself. I'm a senator, a congressman, I work for one of them. You can see people immediately sizing people up in terms of access and seniority and power and so on. You are what you do, not do. We do what we are. We do what we are. Now, clearly in a fallen world, there isn't an opportunity for everyone to do what they are in terms of employment. And you can see that for most people in history, and for many people in the world today, they have to do what their father and mother, their grandparents did before them, and so on, just to put bread on the table. But everyone in society as open and prosperous as this one, certainly middle class and above, can usually choose a way of living that does fit who they are. And so there's this first great theme. And you can see all sorts of attendant problems, for instance, midlife crisis. People have chosen a job or a career which wasn't actually them, but their parents wanted them to do it. Or everyone when they were graduating was flowing that way, and these were the hot, in, cool, neat sort of things people did, and so on. Then they get to 45, 50, they feel square pegs in round holes, and it's not them, and they can't see themselves doing that for the rest of their life, and so on, because they're doing things which are not truly them. But if you think of it, if you're able to do something that's close to the heart of who you are, you'll have an enormous joy in following your calling. Now, a good example of someone who couldn't is the Apostle Paul. The heart of his calling is to be an apostle to the Gentiles. And when he speaks of that, the passion just flows through his writing. But he can't go down to the labor exchange, apostle and Gentiles, 50,000 a year or whatever. Obviously not. So what does he do? He makes tents to support himself in order to be an apostle to the Gentiles. Now, his tent making is clearly a part of his calling because everything we do is. For Paul, it was nearly the heart of his calling. It nearly freed him to do what he was really called to do, which is to bring the gospel to the Gentiles. So think of that one for yourself. As you know yourself, you and your spouse talk to each other, your closest friends or whatever, what is the heart of you? That giftedness that God has given you, all of us are different. My father-in-law built cars for Indianapolis. I could no more build a car that could go tall than stand in my head for a year. Not my gift. Maybe it's your gift. We're all different. Some people are leaders. Some people have gifts of hospitality. Some are organizers. Some are entrepreneurs. Some are followers. Some speak. And some all sorts of things. Ask yourself, what is the core of your gift? And calling always goes back to that. Do what you are. A second great master theme. Calling means everyone, everywhere, in everything. I'm sure all of you know the life of William Wilberforce. My great-great-great-grandfather, Vanden Bury, was a strong friend of William Wilberforce and a supporter of William Wilberforce. You know the story of William Wilberforce. He came to Christ at 26. Young, wealthy, privileged. He beat at Cambridge. He gambled and wild away his time, whoring and various things. He was a member of a whole stream of London clubs like Boodles, and you can almost tell by the name, the sort of thing that it was, Boodles and so on. Anyway, he came to Christ at 26. Immediately, well, now I'm serious about my faith. I should give up everything that I was doing, including my work as a politician. Fortunately, a minister came to him, John Newton, and said, for heaven's sake, don't. Stay where you are. ask Albert, he wants you to do where you are. And you remember when he was 28, 2 years later, he wrote down what is reckoned to be the most audacious personal mission statement in all history. Father Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners. And he did both. And when he died, he was described as the George Washington of humanity. Now, what if he left Parliament and became a minister? Or more importantly, why on earth do you think he had the idea that now he'd come to Christ, he should give up being a politician, automatically become a minister? It was higher. Actually, that idea, which as you know is very common, goes all the way back to an early church historian and bishop called Eusebius, who literally taught that the Christian life is of two characters, the perfect and the permitted. That's his word. The perfect, of course, is spiritual. Monks, nuns, priests, their job is the contemplation of God. The permitted is lay people, farmers, soldiers, lawyers. Their job is engagement. But you can see perfect, permitted. First class, second class. The aristocrats of the soul and the ordinary people. And of course that runs all the way through the Catholic centuries until Martin Luther. And in Martin Luther's little book, Babylonian Captivity, which is not about Paul, one page in two paragraphs, he smashes that almost by an aside. He says, the farmer out in the fields and the farmer's wife in the farmhouse, if they're doing what they're doing as calling by faith to the glory of God, that's just as high and holy as a pastor in the pulpit. Why? There is no higher level. There is no sacred secular. There is no first class, second class. There's no perfect permitted. It is everyone, everywhere, in everything. You have a story, for instance, of just hearing that a few weeks later as the printing presses churned out his book. A couple of Dutch priests read this. The whole way they were doing church was wrong. And so their opening statement was to lock church doors on Sunday evening. Now, if you didn't do that, man, that you wouldn't have this silverware on Sunday morning. But that wasn't their point. Everyone came into the church to worship, to light candles, to pray, to do all sorts of things. The church was the holy place. No, they said, in to worship, but out to live everywhere. Everyone, everywhere, in everything. And that little passage in the Babylonian captivity, historians point out, is one of the seed beds behind the rise of the dignity of modern work, behind the notion of the equality of dignity, which gives rise to democracy, etc., etc., etc. It is everyone, everywhere, and everything. Now, of course, our tragedy is today in evangelical circles, we're back to the Catholic distortion again. And we have phrases like full-time Christian service and so on. We need to get out of that, and I'm sure you do, teaching your kids at school. It is everyone, everywhere, and everything, doing it as unto the Lord, as a matter of all. For a third great master theme, following the call of Jesus means living before one audience, the audience of one. I don't know if you know the name David Lloyd George, of course, the better known name Winston Churchill. They were actually both friends and both great wartime prime ministers, one in the First World War, one in the Second. And they were both extraordinary orators, but there was one huge difference. Lloyd George was, like many American politicians today, very aware of being what's now called other-directed. He took opinion polls, he had focus groups, he had his antenna out always to what other people were thinking. In fact, one of his friends said that when Lloyd George was alone in the room, there was nobody there. Because of course, only who he was in front of other people. Whereas Churchill, by contrast, was described as is impervious to to public opinion as a vibrant bell. He had his inner convictions and so on. Now the Puritans were more like Winston Churchill, and that's where that phrase audience of one comes from. One historian described the Puritans through calling as having gyroscopes within them. They'd swallowed gyroscopes. North, south, east, west, right, wrong, just, true, false, all were internal, not external. Same man described modern American Christians as having swallowed not a gyroscope, but a gallop ball. We're always saying 51% of it is 82% of it, and we're incredibly well attuned to all these sorts of things. But of course, the Puritans are closer to the New Testament than the Old Testament. In other words, we live before one audience, the audience of one. Now, we all have other audiences. We'd be in trouble with it. I had no readers. What's the point of writing? You had no whatevers. And so we all have audiences. Doctors, school teachers, you name it. We have audiences. Nothing wrong with that. But which audience trumps all others as the decisive audience? That's the question. And for the Puritans, it was clearly the Lord. The Lord. Now, that was very practical for them. What was success or failure? Well, people judged it by how well you did economically, or your fame in the recommended community, or whatever. They said, those things were external. We saved by anything external? No. External things are merely dead works. So all that matters if we're approved by the one audience, the audience of one. So, success or failure? Forget it. Well known or not well known? Forget it. All irrelevant. All that matters is we give that one audience say, well done. It is faithfulness, not success, that counts. Now that's a very precious truth. Some of you will have exceedingly tough times. Maybe that for various reasons we need to go into today, our whole culture is moving into a time that's going to be incredibly challenging. We are not called to be successful. We are called to be faithful. Now, we can misuse that and do idiotic things, and then say, I'm being a fool for Christ, and I'm just being a fool. But when you're doing with absolute integrity what you believe to be right for you to do, and you do it as a matter of calling, and to everyone else who looks a failure, and you can comfort yourself, you live before one audience, the audience of one. Now, there are various reasons why that's actually very practical today, in ways it wasn't even for the Puritans. Take, say, the extraordinary wave of leaders' scandals in the church today. Is the current crop of Christian leadership more fallible, more sinful, or whatever than previous? I don't think so. But there are modern reasons for it. For example, the rise of anonymity. Have you ever thought that in the modern world, more people are more anonymous in more situations than ever before, either through travel or through technology? Teenager can come home from school and 15 yards from his or her mother can be in for some program on the internet. The mother hasn't a clue of it. Who knows? Travel and technology make us more anonymous in today's world than ever before in Christian history or human history. Here's the one. In a fallen world, morality has always been linked to accountability through visibility. To say that isn't cynical, it's just a plain fact. Morality has been linked to accountability through visibility. I lived once, when I was at Liberty, in a small village of about 200 people. A rumor or a story could go around the village in about half an hour. Everyone knew what everyone else was doing. Now, with the rise of the industrialized society, it was said in the 19th century, the average Londoner met more people in 1 week than many or less in a lifetime. So every relationship was immediately a revolving door relationship. More and more, the world was anonymous. We which meant, of course, the rise of things like image and impression management and so on. But it also meant the rise of the fact that more people were anonymous, more people were less accountable, and so they did things which, quote, nobody saw. Now you can see, you go right back to Plato, parable of Gyges, the shepherd, who discovers the vessel on the ring he finds and he becomes invisible, and then he can rape the queen and murder the king. And Plato raises the question, what is morality when we're not seen by anyone? But of course, biblically, we're never not seen by anyone, because we're always living before the one audience, the audience of one. And in an age of anonymity, accountability, and the crisis of morality in many, many areas of leadership and other areas too, you can see that this point has additional value. We live before that one audience, the audience of one. I'll take another, and I'll make this the last, and then throw it over to you for questions, and I hope you'll be willing, although we don't have mics, to stand up and come around if you want to. One last thing. Calling focuses what good people can do when the foundations give way. A few years ago, I was speaking in the Congress, and at the end of what I said, a congressman put up his hand, and we'd actually been partly talking about world wars. A congressman put up his hand and said this: if there's a flood, a small boy can put his finger in the dike and be a hero. Specific. But as I look out on America, he said, we're facing a mudslide. Who can do anything? When the foundations give way, as the Old Testament says, what can a good person do? Now you translate that to the level of our global era. Many people talk about the global village. That's actually far too cozy and simple and united. The globalized world, we're more and more dealing with the whole world the whole time. It's bigger than ever before. And it's moving faster than ever before in a day of nanoseconds and instant speed. As one person put it, everything's now interconnected and no one's in charge. And in more and more areas, you get this mudslide effect. What can we do? Not surprisingly, the dominant emotion in the global world is fear. And one of the most common reactions in the global world is, I'm overwhelmed. Calling comes in once again. I see our callings rather like a target, rifle target or a bow and arrow target. The bullseye of the target is where we all live. Some of us here probably live in Rome, our hosts. Many of you, like me, from all parts of this country. But we think of where we live, which is the focus of our callings, but we can go outside that, just as we've come here today. You can travel, you can vote, you can give, you can email, you can do all sorts of things that go out. And the furthest reach of our circles of influence is prayer. And we can pray for countries we couldn't afford a ticket to. Or that maybe you wouldn't allow us in, or whatever. But here's the point. At the end of the day, although we have an extraordinary influence, particularly with all the opportunities we have in a wealthy country like this, at the end of the day, our spheres of influence are limited. Thank God. That's why you can sleep tonight. The Lord's got the whole world in His hands. He alone is sovereign. We're not. All we're responsible for is the spheres of influence of our gifts and our resources. In other words, our calling. And within those spheres and within that calling, it is my utmost for His highest. But beyond that, it's your responsibility, or her responsibility, or His responsibility. And the Lord has millions and millions of others to His followers doing their thing too. And when we all fail and fall short, He's still sovereign in our world, but all we're responsible for. So many people, there was a notion a few years back, strategic callings, and people were saying, these are the strategic spheres of society which Christians must get into. The Lord is the one who's given the gifts. The Lord is the one who's given us our resources, all uniquely. And it's not for me to tell any of you where to go. He calls, He deploys. And as each of us follows our gifts, our calling, our spheres of influence, then we're able to do our small part to meet effects which clearly today are rather like a mudslide. But we have no fear. And the most common refrain of Scripture from beginning to end is, have no fear. Have faith in God. Have no fear. He's in control. What looks like a mudslide to Him and to us is nothing to Him. You can say a lot more about this. But think of this notion of calling. There are many other precious truths in the good news of Jesus. But few speak so intimately to all of us. God called you before you were conceived, if we understand the call of Jeremiah, the call of the servant in Isaiah 49, the understanding of the psalmist in 139. Before we were conceived, when we were in our mother's womb, He called us. He knows you intimately in a way you will never know yourself. And as you rise to follow that call, you will go further, you will go higher, you will go deeper than you could ever imagine. Call is the deepest source of human purpose that history has ever seen. And not surprisingly, it shaped the world and it changed civilizations. But over to you. Let's have a time of questions. Anyone like to raise a point? I'm sorry we don't have a mic. Anyone just likes to stand up? I'll recognize you. And for all the time. Anyone like to get the ball rolling? Always good classical education. One of the key notes I know about classical education is everyone's prepared to discuss it. Yes, ma'am. Do you want to stand up, sir? Would I relate calling to spiritual gifts? My understanding, which I think is a Reformed understanding, it includes natural giftedness and spiritual giftedness. So the Reformers, for instance, interpreted the parable of the talents and pounds as primarily natural talents. And if you think, we all have spiritual gifts, as you can read in the New Testament. But we all have even more natural gifts. The spiritual gifts are mostly to do with the body of Christ and so on, whereas many of our natural gifts, which of course are spiritually sanctified too, have much more to do with the rest of life. So it's neither natural or spiritual. It's both, but we must never leave out the natural. Yes, ma'am. I heard the first part. And what was the first part of the sentence? What would I recommend people do to find their natural and spiritual gifts and so on? Churchill used to call the years 18 to 25 the big 7 years, because it's the time that most people meet their spouses, choose their first jobs, settle on their worldview, and things like that. Now, with calling, though, I think it comes earlier. And the ideal is for parents and for teachers to recognize, to discern, and then to call out giftedness in kids. To encourage and draw them out like a coach does. And to, so that, you know, 8 onwards, people begin to recognize what it is they're good at. And I think all of you are teachers here. You have a tremendous part of that. Now, our problem is in the church today, often the teaching's confused. We've still got a lot of the old spiritual distortion. Spiritual is higher. It's higher to be a minister or a missionary than to be whatever, wherever. So the teaching is confused, and often it's not taught at all. So people commonly choose a job before they're aware of their calling. And the ideal is always to choose a job and then a career in the light of your gifts and calling. Do what you love. In other words, to stop people going into a job because everyone else is doing it, because their parents want them to do it, or whatever. The question is, what is you? Now that is something that should be drawn out much earlier. You know, I was never taught calling. There was a time, my mother was an eminent surgeon, my father was a teacher. Neither of them, frankly, had much interest in ideas. Or what we read is novels, contemporary stuff. At one stage, when I was 10, 12, I thought I was a magpie falling on the wrong nest. I was nothing like that. I was so relieved later to discover I actually liked my grandparents, great grandparents, and so many of my parents were the odd people out. But it's important for me to discover that I was who I was, and I wasn't them. And I went out of my way when my son was young. You could see people coming up to him when he was 8, 10, 12, thinking he was exactly like me. And he takes great delight now in knowing that he's not like me, as I did with my own parents. But that's a matter of drawing people out, you know, as they're growing up, like good coaches do in sports people, and so on, teachers. I was helped most by a magnificent teacher at school. I'm sure many of you will have the same influence on your kids. Yes, sir.
All right, now what do we do, say, in a situation, which we've all seen on reality television, you see, say, American Idol, the guy comes up, I know I'm a good singer, but they're terrible. We often find ourselves as students convinced that they're called to something, but they have no kids.
Statistics, 85% of Swedes think they're above average drivers. You know, 90% of Frenchmen think they're above average lovers. It's not funny when you come down and say, America is great because America is good. You ever found that in Tocqueville? I challenge you to find it. In other words, that little phrase covers all the areas where America is not good. Because she's treated many people extremely equally, including contemporary torture. But we're freedom-loving people. Why do they hate us? Because we're free. And you can see we all tend to do so. So, you sometimes have funny versions and sometimes bad ones. But you always look out for calling being used as God's counter-signature to our sinfulness. So the 60s, this little phrase, do your own thing, some Christians think, well, God told me to X. It's actually them doing their own thing, using God to kind of sign what we want to do. And we're all open to each other. Iron sharpens iron. Paul withstands Peter to the face, as the version says. Don't let any kids get away with that. You know, which is rooted in human nature. We're all self-deceived machines, but it's ugly when we think of ourselves more highly than we should. Growing up in Europe, where the church is in bad shape, we used to call Sundays like that the Continental Sunday, but they'd rejected anything Christian. When I came over here, America, which is far more Christian than most of Europe, has an incredibly secular Sunday. And to go the other way, I live in Washington. When I came, until recently, the great coach who led Washington's national capital city idolatry was a wonderful evangelical brother, Joe Gibbs. Questions like that never arose. And then we all see a film like Chariots of Fire, and we're watching Eric Little, who didn't race on Sunday that one time, and we all praise him in the skies, and no one ever thinks of following him. So I think there's an enormous amount of confusion over that today, and I'm not going to pronounce on it. But America clearly has a very secularized Sunday. And I'm glad to see, in a non-legalistic way, some wonderful books and new teaching beginning to spread about bringing the principles of the Sabbath back in. Now, in my experience, it's mostly not against Sunday sports and the NFL and so on, it has to include that. It's mostly in terms of the fast life we're living. The incredible speed at which we're all living, and people need time out. And we suddenly begin to realize the depth of the importance of the spiritual disciplines. And we suddenly realize the significance of the way Jesus engaged and withdrew. And we're all engaged and hardly have any control, solitude, and so on. So I'm glad it's coming in. I'm sure as part of it's coming in, the spiritual disciplines and so on, there will be a questioning of the ways in which many Americans live their lives on Sunday. And I hope your NFL friends will be part of that discussion. Some of them might have a team. Sorry, that's a slightly evasive answer. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. No, there's no question. American education at a higher level is in trouble. And you have a book like, say, Anthony Cronin, who's an atheist and the former dean of the Yale Law School. He argues that American education at a higher level has lost its purpose. And his critique would be much the same as yours and the ACCS, except he doesn't give any place to religion. But it says it doesn't teach anyone the meaning of life, or what a good life is, and all these various things, because it's so occupationally driven, and it's all in terms of career and credentials and so on, it has profoundly lost its way. And I'm encouraged that books like that are being picked up, because I think the globalized world is leading us to a profound revaluation of education at all sorts of levels. And you just think, for instance, of the way that since the 19th century, the German research university model has dominated American education. And the old book about people so specialized, they know more and more about this and less, and finally know nothing, but everything about nothing, and so on. Well, that's absurd. One of the features of the globalized world is the new generalization of knowledge. You have to bring in historians and philosophers and social scientists and ethicists, and no one's knowledge is complete. We all have to listen to each other. And that's beginning to shake up the whole thing. And that's just the beginning of the way globalization is shaking up things, the information overload and so on. So the things you are doing, or another thing is because of the overload, people need filters, which means they need reading. Yeah, and you guys are doing that so well. So you're right, you're critiquing right present situation, but there's a broad recognition that the present situation is not only wrong, it is going to turn out to be dangerously outdated by the impact of globalized knowledge, and it's changing. I hope you'll be part of the change constructively. You want to stand up?
Yeah. More or less
optimistic about the state of the end of the church? I always duck the word optimism and pessimism because it's psychological. What I try and do always, and I'm sure many of you do the same, is to be realistic with hope. Because no realism by itself is ever a Christian statement, because under God there is always hope. Now, if you look at that particular issue, there's no question we've made enormous leaps since either the book or Mark Knowles' Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, and so on. We've made huge leaps, but they're still broadly true. And one way I respond to that, not just in educational thinking, but broadly, is this: many of the generalizations about the church are true, and they're rather dark. Things in the mind would change. But the exceptions, not generalizations, the exceptions are very encouraging. So if you look around all the green shoots in the last 20 years, what you're doing here, for instance, or new justice initiatives like the Eventual Justice Mission, or the extraordinary interesting new group called the Wedgwood Circle, if you follow them, or bringing together financial investors, angels, with artists who are trying to produce good, constructive culture. And so on, seeding the clouds. There's Socrates in the City in Manhattan. There's lots of terrific things happening. So many of the generalizations are dark. But the exceptions are very encouraging. But I always try and be realistic with hope. Ever dark the hour, God could turn it around in 5 minutes. So we're never despairing. The very backside, now can be.
Modern culture's desire to avoid or to be anonymous and to avoid accountability is really an assault on leadership. How would you have us as educators encourage young men to step into their roles as servant leaders?
Teaching good biblical and classical models of leadership, of vision, of courage, of character, of communication skill, all of which are involved in leading. So just take character. Clearly, for the Bible, take the story of the anointing of David. God does not look on the appearances, but on the heart. Or what I mentioned with Plato, the story of nations. It's all about you are who you are when no one sees. That's character. But here we are where character doesn't matter. Everything is image or color. So the framers insisted on character. Remember John Adams? There's a passage he writes to one of his friends where he piles up words like inalienable, indefeasible, and you think, what's he working towards? And it's a sort of string of words you use about freedom, inalienable rights, and so on. No, he's talking about the people's right to know the character of their leaders. Now, compare that, say, with the Clinton impeachment, when you had that letter from the New York Times and the Washington Post by the American academics who said, in effect, don't worry about character. The president could have the morals of an alley cat. What matters is competence. In other words, we are dead set, as Christians, and you're concerned with classical education, against modern views of leadership without character. But we're beginning to reap the problem. The Wall Street is or whatever. So, we're on the side of scriptures and of the classics, and we believe fundamentally of truth and wisdom. So the alternatives will always prove disastrous, are proving disastrous, And so it's a good time to stress a different way. And you don't stand up for others. I'm not. Whatever that. Well, the first one. Someone hitting midlife crisis is tough because some people have absolutely no chance to change. Now, when you're in that category, you're like most people in the world. And in a fallen world, work is partly under the curse. Created, we're made in the image of God, first curse, that's where our brow, etc. So, Paul encounters that too. You can think, say, of the poems of George Herbert. You know, the person who sweeps the floor, menial, humdrum, but who sweeps the floor for the glory of God, Herbert calls that the philosopher's stone. It turns a menial thing into gold. And that's Paul, the slave who's following his master, following God as a calling, is more free than the master, and so on. So, some people can't change. Now, I know a case, as I can name a case of a man in Colorado, who hit that midlife crisis and realized what he was doing relatively successfully, it wasn't him. In his case, he didn't have terribly much money, but the members of his fellowship group clubbed together and gave him 3 months of his salary to give him the freedom to look for something that was more him. And he found it. And his joy doing what he was, and his gratitude to these brothers and sisters who made that possible, was palpable. Now, not everyone can do that. As I say, the Apostle Paul couldn't. So he made tents to be the Apostle. So you've got to figure out. But it's never too late. Never too late. Oh, you want to ask about it? I didn't go to a Christian school, I went to an English boarding school, but we were taught Latin and Greek from 9 onwards, starting off with Herodotus, people like that. I just took it as natural that everyone did that sort of thing. It wasn't until later that I realized it was a little unusual. So, I mean, I absolutely loved it. In my case, it wasn't so much the languages that I loved, it was Roman and Greek history and the way their ideas shaped Western history and things like that, and so on, plays of Aeschylus, and the writings of Cicero, and so on. So I'll show tomorrow, I won't get into where America is today. And I'm so impressed with the founder's understanding of people like Cicero or Polybius. I'm not a political scientist, I'm a social scientist. But when I move over into political science, I do it in a classical European way, which is what's called regime analysis. In other words, like Tocqueville or Montesquieu, you're looking at human nature, and you're looking at the rise and fall of regimes, the characteristics of them, and so you can figure out where we are today in the light of that, which is pretty unlike modern American political science, with polls about this district's there, and so on. I think they totally miss human nature and the whole sense of history. So the school I went to didn't give me a self-conscious view of the classics, it just came down with books by. I'm just incredibly grateful for it, Latin, Greek, Roman history, and so on. But it wasn't just taught in the dull way. As I said, I can see my headmaster. And when I went to school, you know, he had his Oxford academic calendar on, which he twirls, he raced around the floor. And I just see him talking about Pericles, or about Julius Caesar, or Tiberius Gracchus, or something like that, as if he knew these people. And for me, it was incredibly inspiring and inspiring to see history come alive. I didn't know that's what I was about. How extraordinarily rare that was. If Tell me how to mention you want.
Yes, sir.
Going to a meeting once, I imagine you can say that it's on tape. And they asked me what I would suggest that they could think through that their education could be more Christian. And I said, you should think through the biblical notion of discipleship and tutoring. Whereupon it sort of fell on deaf ears very fast. You know, some story, but the point is, I went to Oxford, which is a very secular university. And yet the whole of the education depends on tutoring. At Oxford, you don't have to go to a single lecture if you don't want to. But twice a week, you turn up alone with your tutor. And he or she sent you an essay question and told you four or five books to read, writing it. You read it aloud, he or she rips it apart, and you defend it as best you can. Everything is done in that. You have an academic tutor, and you have a moral tutor. Now, Oxford is very secular, but that obviously goes back to Jesus, or even earlier, to Plato and Socrates and so on. So obviously the idea behind that is that the deepest knowledge is tacit. There's more to knowing than knowing will ever know. So the deepest knowledge has to be learned not in lectures or seminars or sermons or speeches, but under a master from his authority in the experience of life. And that's the heart of discipleship, and why Jesus is closer to Socrates than he is to many modern Christian professors. And we've almost completely lost that. Now, that was picked up later in the guilds. And so a master goldsmith or a master painter in Florence would tutor the apprentice. And turn the apprentice into a master in turn. Now, being said, I love apologetics. I'm not a full-time apologist or anything, but I go on campuses when I can. I have not sat through, think carefully, I think I sat through a week of apologetic seminars or anything like that. And being to a seminary like that, but I learned from Francis Schaeffer in practice. To be honest, I haven't read any of his books for the simple reason I heard them all given before they were written. But I learned far more from, I mean, he has little bits on apologetics, David Carter was there. It gives you no idea how he did it. And the words don't convey. When Schaeffer talked to someone, after about 5 minutes, you could see his eyes welling up with tears. He was so empathetic with people that he was engaged with. He loved them palpably. You can't put that in words. You just see that, and so on. So, if I understand your question, that whole notion of discipling, tutoring, mentoring's a little thin, I think. Tutoring's far deeper than just mentoring. It's more than I. It's actually that apprentice copying, and so on. Very, very important part of what you're doing if you're doing classical and Christian education. Thank you.